This is the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President, Tony Perkins.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkeld, and I'm sitting in for Tony, who is taking some time away from the microphone. Earlier this week on Washington Watch Live, Louisiana State Representative Mike Johnson guest hosted for Tony, and he had a chance to talk with a couple of folks about the passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and his impact on the country. Here's Mike Johnson as he talks with Senior Legal Counsel at Alliance Defending Freedom, Jeremy Tedesco.
Jeremy, do we have you on the phone?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing, Mike?
Hey, brother. Good. Good to hear your voice. And even on this sad occasion, good to talk with you. How many years have you been with ADF now, Jeremy?
11 years.
11 years. Time flies, my friend.
Yes, it does.
And,
it really does.
And you're a senior counsel now, and so you litigate. ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, for those who don't know, is the nation's largest organization that defends religious freedom and the sanctity of human life and marriage and the family. And Jeremy does a great job helping to lead the litigation group on that. And so, Jeremy, you specialize in, or you focus all your attention on constitutional law matters. So I would suspect, and I know because you're a friend, that Justice Scalia was near and dear to your heart as he was to mine. Tell me what the loss of Justice Scalia has meant to ADF and really to the nation.
Yeah, you know, it was such sad news to hear. On Saturday, I was spending some really great quality time with one of my kids when I looked down at my phone, as I'm, you know, want to do from time to time, even when I probably shouldn't, and shouldn't be looking at it. And I saw this article that Justice Scalia had died. I couldn't believe it. First, I thought it was a article from The Onion or some, you know, farcical news service. I confirmed it quickly and was just, you know, frankly saddened and deeply concerned. At the same time, I know that the loss of this one man on the court doesn't shake God's hand and his provision and his you know, his control over the affairs of men. And so, you know, I trust God moving forward to see us through what we see in our, you know, through our own kind of finite eyes as a terrible loss. And it is. Let's be honest. Justice Scalia was one of the great lions on the court when it came to originalism and interpreting the Constitution and statutes according to the intention of those who framed and passed them, something that many of the liberal justices on the court just don't adhere to. They're going to impute whatever meaning they want to the Constitution to get to the result they want. And Justice Scalia was obviously one of the most important jurists, as you said, of this generation and probably of the century. He might go down as one of the greatest justices that ever served in the history of the United States Supreme Court.
He dramatically influenced a generation of lawyers. You know, you and I are about the same age. We came up the same time. And I mean, he was a primary influence upon me individually to pursue constitutional law.
Sure.
I suspect he probably had a similar effect on you.
Many of us that work in the organizations that we do so, and to some extent because Justice Scalia inspired us. He certainly inspired me. You know, we all revered him when we went through law school. The conservative legal community, he's the most revered justice of our day in the conservative legal community. He certainly speaks for all of us. At least he did when he was writing those, you know, it's a very pointed and sometimes very biting, but unbelievably well-worded dissents when, you know, things were off the rails from the left side of the court. Yet when he was in the majority, he always wrote a very measured opinion that was, you know, true to the constitutional text and meaning that the founders intended when they drafted in the Constitution when it was ratified. And that's the whole point of Scalia's jurisprudence, right, is that the Constitution has a meaning. It's the government only has the power that the people granted to it through a Constitution that has words that have real meaning. And you can't just change that meaning, you know, every generation or, you know, with every new cultural movement or you know, popular cultural idea that happens to be, you know, in vogue at a certain time. That's not the way the Constitution works. It's really not a constitution at all if it changes based on the whims of, you know, present-day culture.
Well, and that's
so
right, yeah.
Justice Scalia, he was the greatest proponent of that on the court. And I certainly, there's certainly several justices on the court that still strongly adhere to that point of view, so we're not going to lose that voice. But Scalia was definitely most identified with advancing it.
Well, there's no doubt about it, and I think he was so revered because of his professional life that you've described. He was the textualist and originalist. The Constitution is not a living, breathing document, as some of the modern progressives and liberals like to say. It means what it says. It ought to be strictly interpreted and applied as it was written. That was, as you said, that was Justice Scalia's basic premise. And what I liked about him is he refused to invent new rights that clearly aren't written in the Constitution. You know, and of course he would strictly vote to enforce the rights that are there. And that's what we want in a justice, in any judge, right? We want, as Roberts said during his confirmation hearing, we want an umpire. We want a neutral umpire. He's supposed to call it as he sees it according to the Constitution and not just invent a Constitution as he's going along, as Scalia sometimes criticized his colleagues on the bench. But, you know, that's his professional life. But you know what? What we also revered about him, Jeremy, and I know you could testify to the same, is in his personal life, he was so authentic. You know, he had true integrity. And we're hearing all the stories of everyone who are coming out this week, sharing their own personal reflections on that. And I read a piece just last night that someone posted. They saw him in a church a few years ago. He was Roman Catholic, of course, faithful to his faith. And he was there praying quietly. And there was only three people in the church. This gentleman was standing in the back in the shadows, and Justice Scalia did not know he was there or that he was being observed. But he tells the story of a lady who had open sores all over her body, obviously in great distress, and she was walking out of the church, and Justice Scalia just reached out and embraced her. And not for show, not to do it because he thought anyone was watching, but just because that's the true heart of a man of faith and what he really stood for. And that's why we respected him so much. I know you've heard a lot of that as well this week.
There's no question. I think the thing that always surprises people, it's so funny, you know, that he was great friends with Justice Ginsburg. You know, these
right.
are the two polar opposites when it comes to their views of the Constitution and of, you know, rights and you know, any issue that comes to the court. You can almost be certain that they're, especially a contentious social issue, that they're likely to be on the other side of the, complete other side of the issue. Yet they had one of probably the strongest friendship on the bench, and that just attests to his character as well. He didn't let that get in the way of forging a very strong friendship. And I understand he had a similar relationship with Elena Kagan on the Supreme Court as well. And that's the way we are called to be as Christians. We're not called to, you know, be enemies with people that we disagree with. We were called to recognize everybody as you know, made in the image of God and due
right.
respect and dignity. And that's how he operated. And he, as you said, it was genuine. It was authentic. That's proof of it. I'd say the other thing about him, I saw him speak a few times, most recently in June of 2015, and he was one of the funniest men I've ever
yes, he was.
Listen to his speech. He was just unbelievably funny. I he told some of the funniest stories I have ever heard. I laughed so hard I wasn't really expecting to walk out of there with my eyes tearing up from all the laughter.
Right.
But he's just he was a guy who really loved life, loved his job, loved his family. From all reports I hear and read, you know, and I got to see a little bit of that in action, live and in person every once in a while. And so, you know, it's a terrible loss to the court. You know, I think we can't imagine the Supreme Court without Antonin Scalia, but that institution will go on. And obviously our hope here at ADF is that the next president of the United States, however the election pans out, will be the one appointing a justice to replace Justice Scalia.
Well, that's right. And I was going to ask you, are there any cases that you would want to highlight just in a minute here that people need to be watching or maybe praying about now in
yeah,
earnest?
Well, absolutely. They can pray for two of our cases that have been granted and will be heard either this term or next term. And that's the cases challenging the HHS mandate, the Obamacare abortion mandate.
Huge.
This time as applied to religious colleges and universities that object to providing
yes,
insurance coverage for these abortion-causing drugs and devices. And then the other one is our Trinity Lutheran case, which deals with the state of Missouri refusing to provide rubber pellets for playground at a church simply because it was a church that was requesting these rubber pellets for their playground to keep the kids safe. They'd give it to anybody else.
But not the Christians, right? That's the big problem. Hey, Jeremy Tedesco, thank you for the update. Thank you for doing what you do at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Stay with us. We'll be right back for more reflections on the life of Justice Scalia.
Have you ever tried to find data on marriage or religion but didn't know where to find it? The Marriage and Religion Research Institute has just released an online social science encyclopedia. It's called Maripedia. Maripedia provides data on all matters related to family, marriage, religion, and sexuality. It is an important resource for anyone who wants to become an informed player in improving society. Visit Maripedia.org today to access this faith-affirming research. That's Maripedia.org.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld, and while Tony is taking some time off, we're sharing a couple of the best interviews from Washington Watch Live from the past week. Earlier, we heard from Alliance Defending Freedom's Jeremy Tedesco concerning the life of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, with his thoughts on Justice Scalia, here's FRC Senior Fellow for Family Empowerment, Ken Blackwell, along with guest host, Louisiana State Representative Mike Johnson.
Ken, thanks so much for being with us this afternoon.
Mike, it's a delight to be with you. And yes, I knew Justice Scalia. I thought he was one of the greatest Supreme Court justices of all time. His intellect was admired by Americans of all political persuasions, and he had mastered that art of being able to disagree vigorously with his colleagues without being disagreeable.
Well, and what a great example that is to, and was, to so many of us who are engaged in these battles for the culture as you've been for so many years, Ken. And I've admired that about you, the way that you do that, that we can disagree with people on the other side without being disagreeable. After all, we're called to be winsome witnesses to the truth, right? And I fear sometimes people on our side don't get that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I tell you, I was in awe of Justice Scalia's intellect, his consistent fidelity to the text and original meaning of the Constitution, and his fundamental understanding of what had helped make and shape us into an exceptional nation in all of human history. And so he was a fierce defender of the Constitution and its original meaning, and he understood and appreciated that if the Constitution needed to be changed, there was a deliberate and reflective process.
That's right.
That the voters of the country could go through.
And that if it was going to be amended, then it would need to be done by broad social consensus, as he always explained and stood by that principle, and not at the hands of nine unelected lawyers. Because Justice Scalia thought that would be dangerous. If you regarded the Constitution as a document that could just change with the times whenever a majority of nine justices agreed, then we would untie from the moorings, as it were. We would leave our foundations, and it would put the nation in peril.
Absolutely, Mike. You know, look, every American has been affected by Justice Scalia in his 30 years on the Supreme Court. And I think that every American will be affected by his death and his absence from the court. And so I think it's imperative that we interject Americans back into this process. We have a deeply divided country, and there's voter dissatisfaction that is running high, and the American people should have a voice in the selection of the next Supreme Court justice, and they can do that by picking the next president. And I think that vacancy that has been created should not be filled until we have a new president. And it is pretty straightforward proposition. If you think that the Democrats should get to replace the arch conservative hero of individual liberty, mm-hmm. then you vote for a Democrat. If you think that the narrow 5-4 conservative majority on the court has served the country well, then you vote for the Republican. And it strikes me that this is precisely how a constitutional republic should function.
I could not agree more, and it does give us sort of a perfect, sort of a quintessential opportunity, example of representative government, right? That we can use this election, you know, as a referendum on a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, and that doesn't happen very often and hasn't happened very often in our history. And so here it is. And I think, you know, really what you've just explained there is a great, I think it would be a great thing to honor the memory of Justice Scalia, who stood for that very principle. The government of the people, by the people, for the people, ostensibly, is what all of this is about. And so what an important point. Now, I was reading a piece that you wrote about this, Ken, just reflecting on the loss of Justice Scalia and saying what, you know, what a profound influence he had upon everyone throughout the country, as you said. But you also made this point about how the current president, of course, President Obama, has consistently ignored the law, and he has shown really a contempt for the Constitution. I think that's why you've made the point just a couple of minutes here left. But this election is going to have huge consequences, is it not?
Oh, it really is, and I think the people should have a say in replacing Justice Scalia, and you know, those who argue that this vacancy needs to be filled quickly, they should understand that the court regularly decides cases with 8 justices, and it's been 80 years since a justice has been confirmed to an election year vacancy.
Right.
So I think it's very important that we give people, the people, a chance to reestablish the balance of power between the branches of government, and to let their voice be heard in this important election.
I think that was very well said. Ken, thank you so much for all you do and have done for the nation. I'm a big fan of yours and grateful for your work, and especially for what you do here at the Family Research Council. Thanks for being with us this afternoon. You got it.
You can find out more about Ken Blackwell, Jeremy Tedesco, as well as Justice Antonin Scalia when you visit TonyPerkins.com. We'll be right back with more from the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this. Don't go away.
We are grateful for our military, for the men and women who have risked their lives so we can be free. Free to speak our minds, to associate, and to practice our faith. Many members of our military have a strong Christian faith, one that supports and motivates their sacrifice. Some of them, however, are facing pressure to abandon that faith. We won't stand for that. We believe their religious freedom is worth protecting. To follow this issue on Facebook or Twitter, find us at #MilitaryFreedom.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. One thing almost every family deals with this time of year is taxes. And too often, those taxes aren't helping families, but rather lining the pockets of bureaucrats in Washington. Well, next up, Louisiana State Representative Mike Johnson talks with Chris Edwards, the Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, about the moral arguments against high taxes. Here's Representative Mike Johnson.
Chris, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
I am glad to have you because, as I mentioned here at the outset of our discussion, I'm a legislator down in the state of Louisiana in the state House of Representatives, and our state, like many others, is going through a massive budget crisis. So the latest forecast for the state is that we're facing, going into next year, a $2 billion deficit for the state's finances. And our governor down here is a Democrat, and he has come out with a laundry list of new tax proposals because they just insist that we must have truckloads of new revenue. And that's how we're going to solve the problem, is new revenue, new taxes. They don't want to talk about cutting government, really. They don't want to talk about structural change to the budget. They just want to talk about taxes. And so what I found, Chris, the reason I wanted to have you on so much this afternoon, what I found over the last week or so in talking with friends and colleagues and associates and people out in the grassroots is that people are against taxes, but so few are able to articulate exactly why. And so I thought it would be useful to get back to the basics. You know, why is it that we should oppose an increase in taxes? What's the basic philosophy behind it? So you've written extensively about
it. Well, the most basic reason is that we know that governments, federal and state, are not working very well. They are not providing the services they promise. They are providing those services far too costly. We read about waste and cost overruns in government all the time. So, you know, I think Americans would be willing to pay their taxes more if they saw that government was working more efficiently and they saw that politicians really were trying to cut out the waste and the fat. I mean, there's a big revolt we can see with the Republican presidential campaign this year. People are sick and tired of politicians promising to make government work better than you know, it just doesn't. So that revolt is then, you know, channeled into resistance against tax hikes if people don't think they're getting their money's worth.
Well, that's right. And you make a great point. Cato has just put out some great information on all this, as the organization has been doing for many years. But one of the primary points, and I think you're hitting on there, is that private individuals and businesses use money more efficiently than governments do. In every case, all the time.
That's right. And the thing that I find stunning is that you think about private sector industries that are competitive, like, you know, the computer industry and televisions or furniture or clothing or grocery or the grocery store food. Businesses are constantly competing to cut costs and give you better quality. And so prices over the decades have fallen for things like food and television sets and all kinds of other stuff. Why doesn't that happen with government? Why are government services always getting more expensive? It's because there's no competition. The governments have monopolies. And monopolies, whether it's the Postal Service or the K-12 schools, monopolies don't work very well because there's no incentive for the people who run those monopoly systems to provide better services at lower cost.
And consequently, then, it leads us to the conclusion that money obviously does more good for more people when it's in private hands than in government hands, right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, if you think about, the basic things that governments do are of extremely high value. Police, fire, national defense, we all agree that's high value stuff. But the problem now is that governments in the United States consume about 40% of the entire GDP. They grab a huge slice of the entire economy. So sort of the extra things they're doing at the top end there are really of low value. But when they take money from the private sector, they're taking it from entrepreneurs and business people who would otherwise use the money to expand factories and create more jobs. So, you know, as economists say, sort of at the margin, the money is worth much more in the private sector where it can create jobs than it is in the government where it is often wasted.
Well, that's right. And the most fundamental reason to cut taxes, some would argue, is this understanding that wealth doesn't just happen, right? It has to be produced. And the government is never going to produce wealth. They're just going to take it from others and redistribute it, as it were, right? So
In the private sector, you think about businesses, they're always, you know, the word profits has become sort of an evil word in businesses. But what profits are is businesses are generating more value and they're creating value for their customers more than the cost of production. And so it creates this positive surplus. It's a win-win game for society when businesses produce more with less. Governments don't work on a win-win basis. They take money from some and give to others. It's sort of a zero-sum game. And I think that's a real fundamental difference between the private sector and not just business activity, but private nonprofit and charitable activities as well. They are win-win because people involved in both charitable and business activities, those are voluntary activities. People take part in them because they can gain value and provide value to other people. Governments don't work like that. They take from some and give to others. They regulate, which forces people to do things they don't want to do. So government is zero sum and the private sector is win-win.
Exactly right. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Chris Edwards, who's a tax policy expert at the Cato Institute, and Mike Johnson filling in for Tony Perkins. We're talking about this subject because it is a big deal, especially in an election year and in a number of states like my own home state in Louisiana, where we have a massive budget deficit. And the suggestions right now are to just go out and raise more taxes. And we're trying to make the point that is not the smart way to go about fixing the problem. Now, one of the other basic premises that we work upon, Chris, those of us who oppose high taxes, is that we say that high taxes discourage work and investment. Have you seen that having that effect? I mean, you've studied this your whole career.
Well, that's absolutely right, and you can certainly see that. Business taxation is the easiest way to see that. We live in an incredibly competitive national economy and global economy these days, and Louisiana, for example, already has a high corporate tax at 8%. Well, corporations don't have to invest in Louisiana if they don't want to. They can invest in the other 49 states. They can invest in Mexico. So why state governments even have corporate taxes is beyond me. I think they ought to abolish them. They ought to have a welcoming put down the welcome mat for businesses. Businesses build more factories. That hires more workers, and incomes would rise. The curious thing about governments, and I see this with the array of tax hikes being proposed there in Louisiana, higher income and sales tax, higher alcohol, cigarette taxes. With cigarette taxes, governments always say they want to raise the cigarette taxes to discourage smoking. So in that case, politicians get, you know, understand that, you know, raising the price of something, you hit less of it, okay? But in everything else, it works the same way. You raise taxes on working, you get less work. You raise taxes on sales, people consume less of the things they need. And you raise taxes on telephones, like the being proposed in Louisiana, you're going to get less use. So, you know, there is that basic principle. The more you tax something, you're going to get less of it. And the problem is governments seem to always want to tax these useful things like working and investing.
That's a great point. And you're right. The analogy, the same people who argue for the higher cigarette tax will say that. They'll tell you straight to your face, well, we're doing that because we want to provide a disincentive for teens to pick up smoking, et cetera. And that's certainly a noble goal. But then they'll turn right around and tax the other things that we need more of. So that's a great point. Chris Edwards with the Cato Institute, thank you so much for your expertise and this good explanation this afternoon. I think it's a good reminder to everyone, we've got to downsize the scope of government. Chris, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
And a big thank you to Louisiana State Representative Mike Johnson for his help this week. You can find out more about today's guest when you go to TonyPerkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkel, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234.